Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Just for Freedom of Faith. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, this is Arthur.
Oh, Arthur, Preston, Washington here. Welcome to the Guest of Freedom. I'm fine tonight. And for our listening audience, my name is Preston Washington. I'm your host for the Guest of Freedom. Executive producer is Leslie Gist. Our guest tonight is the grandson of W.E.B. Du Bois, Arthur McFarlane. And what we're doing tonight is recapping and talking about the events at the Democratic National Convention recently concluded in North Carolina. Were you in attendance, Arthur?
No, I sure wasn't. Okay. I was at home, but I watched a good deal of it. I didn't watch it all, but I watched a fair amount.
Okay. And what was the highlight for you? What are some of the things that stood out for you? And I understand we may have some clips that we're going to play.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think there were a number of things. Obviously, I really enjoyed the president's speech, and I greatly enjoyed his wife's speech, Michelle Obama's speech. And I really thought that Joe Biden did a great job, and of course, really enjoyed the former President Clinton's speech. He seems to have a knack for getting to the heart of a number of issues, and so those were all ones that I listened to and thought went very well. I think the convention as a whole, as conventions B, was sort of, okay, pump up everybody and get everybody kind of fired up, which was great, but there were several comments, I think, that were made that really hit home for me.
Okay, right now I think we're going to listen to a clip of Obama's convention address in 2004 as a senator, and he spoke on behalf of John Kerry.
Next senator
we'll
from
comment.
The state of Illinois, Barack Obama.
Fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us. The spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. In the end, In the end, that's what this election is about. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope? The hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too. Hope in the face of difficulty. Hope in the face of uncertainty. The audacity of hope. In the end, that is God's greatest gift to us, the bedrock of this nation. A belief in things not seen. A belief that there are better days ahead.
Oh, very powerful speech. Any comments on that, Arthur?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that struck me in what he was saying then is this is not an issue of a black America or a Latino America or a white America. This is an issue of America. And I think that was really what the grandpa and the folks who helped to found the NAACP were after, the Joel Spingarns and the Ida B. Wells. And those folks really were very much interested in making America greater. I think the thing that many people don't know about the NAACP and the founding of the NAACP was that many of the people who were really at the core of the founding of the NAACP were white. And they were the ones who were trying to fight against lynching, who saw lynching as being something that needed to stop in the United States. And so they founded an organization that was not based on being black or being white or being anything, but rather based on making it a better country. And I heard echoes of that in what then Senator Obama was saying. I also heard him talking about the songs around the campfires being sung by the former slaves. And that echoed for me in the work that Grandpa did in The Souls of Black Folk, where he takes some of the old Negro songs and the songs that the slaves were singing that he heard as he was teaching school in the area around Nashville, where he went to undergraduate school. He went to undergraduate school at Fisk. And he took those songs and he put bits and pieces of the songs and the melodies at the beginnings of the chapters of The Souls of Black Folk. He called them the sorrow songs. And in fact, there is a chapter, the last chapter in Souls of Black Folk is called Of the Sorrow Songs. And so I heard that in Obama's speech from 2008 as well. I think that echo from then to now of all of the issues related to growing up black in the United States and knowing that growing up, if you will, started with an involuntary movement from home countries in Africa to the United States via the transatlantic slave trade. So I think it's very interesting to hear those kinds of historical references that continue to affect us and impact us today in the United States.
Okay, we're going to introduce the next clip now. That first one was from 2008, and here we are in 2012. With the next clip.
Mm-hmm. You know, I recognize that times have changed since I first spoke to this convention. Times have changed, and so have I. I'm no longer just a candidate. I'm the president.
Yeah, quite spoken as a brother, huh? What do you think of that?
Exactly. Yeah, I really think that's really true. I mean, I sort of expected his next line when he said, you know, I'm no longer a candidate. I expected the next line to be something different, because he seemed to start it out saying, you know, that or indicating that he had changed, and he said it in such a humble sort of way that I really sort of expected the next line to be something different than I'm the president. But so when he said that, it to me, it seemed that much stronger, because I thought he was going in another direction. And mm-hmm. for him to say, you know, no, I'm no longer a candidate for the presidency of the United States, but here I stand in front of you as the president of the United States, is to say, hello, you know, if it hasn't been, you know, pretty obvious to folks up to now, here is someone who is standing up for who he is and for what he believes in, and he's not backing down. He is going forward, and I know, you know, that whole forward business is part of his campaign, and I don't mean to use it in that way, but to say that that is what he truly believes, and in that way, saying, I'm no longer a candidate, I am the president, is powerful, very powerful.
It seems to be an inference there, too, and don't you forget it to certain people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to do another clip here from the president, again from 2012, DNC convention.
If you turn away now, if you buy into the cynicism that the change we fought for is impossible, if you give up on the idea that your voice can make a difference, then other voices will fill the void. The lobbyists and special interests, the people with the $10 million checks who are trying to buy this election, and those who are trying to make it harder for you to vote. Washington politicians who want to decide who you can marry or control health care choices that women should be making for themselves.
He's calling out the faithful for the vote.
Absolutely. He's hitting on all cylinders there, on all the folks who really need to be out and who are traditionally perceived as being in the Democratic camp. But I think the thing that he really said to me in that portion is about cynicism versus hope. It's this choice that you can make between, let's be the party of no, always saying no to things, always putting things on hold, always putting things on the back burner, which the Republicans have been doing throughout this entire time for the president, or you can continue down the road that he started to go down. I have to be honest, there was a point in there, you know, before President Obama was elected, many years before he was elected, that I believe that there really wasn't much of a difference between Republicans and Democrats, that they were all rich and that they all had the money to run for national office, and that there really wasn't that much of a difference between the policies that one would propose and the other would propose. And the point at which I diverged from that thought and that feeling was with the Bush administration, with George H.W. Bush administration, in which I truly believe we would have gone in a very, very different direction if Al Gore had been elected. I don't think we would have ended up in Iraq and may not have ended up in Afghanistan. I certainly don't think we would have spent the trillions or, you know, billions, hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars on those wars. And I certainly believe we would have gone in a very different direction in terms of the environment, because Al Gore was really very on the track of that, and Bush was not at all, was not interested and didn't believe it and thought it was all hocus pocus. And so, you know, that was the point at which I came to the conclusion that there really is a very big difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. And I think what Obama has done in his speech at this convention is to draw the lines in those differences more clearly. And I think that is an important part for us to look at and understand.
Did your grandfather ever support a presidential candidate, or did he ever identify with a political party?
You know, his political picture changed over his lifetime. There were points when he had supported folks for president, and honestly, I can't, in my mind right now, I'm not thinking of some of the ones that he actually came out in support of, but there were a couple of choices in there, as I recall, historically, that had some meaningfulness. Because he proposed those or he put those out there, and there were some disagreement from folks on the NAACP board, and that caused some rifts because Grandpa was the one writing in the crisis. But you know, his position was always left, and it was you know, the folks who founded the NAACP in 1909 were very left. Some of them socialists, that far left, and so
wow, okay.
Yeah. And those were the people we hung out with.
We're going to listen to our next clip where Obama is talking about Mitt's remedy for the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our friends down in Tampa at the Republican convention were more than happy to talk about everything they think is wrong with America. But they didn't have much to say about how they'd make it right. They want your vote, but they don't want you to know their plan. And that's because all they have to offer is the same prescriptions they've had for the last 30 years. Have a surplus? Try a tax cut. Deficit too high? Try another. Feel a cold coming on? Take two tax cuts, roll back some regulations, and call us in the morning.
Turn Romney into a pharmacist.
I thought that was the greatest. I mean, you know, at some point in all of this serious rhetoric, you've got to introduce some kind of comedy or some kind of at least humor. And I thought that was
exactly
the best line, the most humorous line in his entire speech. But the underlying thing that you've got there is extremely serious. The whole idea of who gets tax cuts and who gets tax breaks and who doesn't is a clear difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. And the thing that I think might have slipped below the radar screen for many people was that last piece where he says, you know, take two tax cuts and some rollbacks and call me in the morning. And it's like the rollback piece, the whole environmental rollback piece, the whole regulatory rollback piece is an incredibly important difference between the Republicans and the Democrats that even though many people have touched on it, I don't think they really dug into it to see what it means. I know that the data has come out that we have opened up more land in the Obama administration to oil drilling, and that then has been true, was true for the Bush administration. And that's an interesting statement, but I think the real statement in there is the where. And it's the where that I think has been extremely important and different between the Republicans and the Democrats.
And, you know, I think a lot of those deals take time, and they had their birth back in the Republican administration.
I agree.
They just came to fruition during the Obama years.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are being critical that he's always blaming the Republicans for a lot of his troubles, but I think there's a lot of truth to that.
I think he probably could have stopped some of that work through, you know, the EPA or some of that, but at the same time, I think he clearly wants to put together an energy policy that is a balance of what we can do in the United States for ourselves. So energy and oil that comes from the United States that is drilled here reduces our dependence on foreign oil. Wind and solar and geothermal kinds of applications, I think, are all in his mix. And so those are the kinds of things. I think the Bush administration was pretty driven towards just the one oil-related piece of the puzzle, which, you know, obviously it's better for their perspective, their family, the Bush family and their friends. But I think Obama clearly wants to have an American-driven but very diverse energy approach, which I fully appreciate as an environmentalist.
Let's listen to his next clip where he talks about his dependence on prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, in that particular piece, And hopefully we're working on it, and hopefully it'll it'll come up here in a minute. But he was he likened himself to President Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of having nowhere else to go but his knees, and
right.
how many times that he had done that. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I think the quote that he came out with was he was driven to his knees many times by the conviction and he had no place else to go. And I think it's that the interesting part of that is the word conviction. He really comes out and says that, in fact, the weight of this office, the weight of these decisions is huge. I know he's joked on a couple, three or four occasions about how his hair has turned gray, and I know we've joked historically about presidents who, like Bill Clinton, who went almost completely gray during his presidency, and George H.W. Bush, who went significantly more gray during his presidency. But, I can't imagine that anyone who would be in that office could find themselves in a place other than on their knees often, because you're in the seat that is supposedly the most powerful on the planet, and you still don't have answers. You still don't have solutions. You still have to struggle. You still have to make choices that are just, there's no good choice. They're not sustaining. Yeah. They're just bad. And so, but you still have to make them. And so I can't imagine a more honest statement about being the president of the United States than that one.
And you have to deal with some dark forces known as the United States Congress. I think we'll go ahead with our clips and with Michelle Obama. Are you there, Arthur?
Yes, I sure am. Yeah, I know the clip that you were looking for there around Michelle is one in which she talks about the dignity and decency of people of her husband and the honesty
exactly.
and integrity of her husband. And I think the thing that struck me when she was talking about him was how he values the opinions of others. I think it is very easy to be a person in power, regardless as to what level of power you're in, and to sort of believe that because of that power that you've been given, you have the answer, and you're always going to have the answer. That old sort of cliche saying of power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think that he, in terms of her look at him, her position, her vantage point to see him, tells us that, in fact, that he really does value those other opinions. And that's, I think, is huge. And to go back to the JFK administration and the Bay of Pigs and some of the decisions that were made in that administration, the term that Janice came up with called groupthink, because of some of the things that some of the decisions that the JFK administration made, does not appear to be the case here for this administration. And I know, looking back on some of the things that Grandpa has said, in terms of government and government leadership and the kinds of decisions that government makes, really, he would have been drawn to Obama's style of leadership.
Okay, my engineers tell me that we're going to try the prayer clip here from President Obama.
Okay.
All right.
And while I'm very proud of what we've achieved together, I'm far more mindful of my own failings, knowing exactly what Lincoln meant when he said, "I have been driven to my knees many times by the overwhelming conviction that I had no place else to go." But as I stand here, I have never been more hopeful about America. Not because I think I have all the answers, not because I'm naive about the magnitude of our challenges. I'm hopeful because of you.
Well, that's an unusual quality in a president, humility.
Exactly. I think that was something that many, many people have said about him in the last couple of years is that they felt like he was not very humble, that he was somewhat aloof in that way. And I think it's a criticism that that a number of people had also of former President Jimmy Carter, who was also a very, very bright man and who took things in a sort of very logical and scientific way. But I think that much like Carter, you get to see that Obama is not like that. He really has this other side. He doesn't let us see it very often, but when he does let us see it, we have to be struck by the fact that, he is willing to say, you know, I'm not always right. I don't always have the answers. Exactly. I'm not always on top of everything, but I'm hopeful. And although people, the Republicans, the right, has taken that word, hope, and changed it into something that is supposed to be a bad thing, I don't believe that. And I think that's really another huge difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. I think that, perhaps the word hope is something that they can't get behind. And that's unfortunate. I feel badly for them in many ways if they can't. Because it's a huge thing to have.
You know, they're only hoping that Obama doesn't get reelected. We're going to go to the clips again, and we're going to bring up Michelle Obama. Here we go.
We learned about dignity and decency, that how hard you work matters more than how much you make, that helping others means more than just getting ahead yourself. We learned about honesty and integrity, that the truth matters, that you don't take shortcuts or play by your own set of rules. And success doesn't count unless you earn it fair and square. We learned about gratitude and humility, that so many people had a hand in our success, from the teachers who inspired us to the janitors who kept our school clean. And we were taught to value everyone's contribution and treat everyone with respect. Those are the values that Barack and I and so many of you are trying to pass on to our own children. That's who we are. And standing before you 4 years ago, I knew that I didn't want any of that to change if Barack became president. Well, today, after so many struggles and triumphs and moments that have tested my husband in ways I never could have imagined, I have seen firsthand that being president doesn't change who you are. No, it reveals who you are.
Well, she knocked that one out of the park.
There's no doubt, absolutely no doubt there. I mean, I've heard that speech that she gave a number of times, and what it reminds me of is my father. I mean, the values that my father tried to teach me when I was in junior high school and high school and growing up was how you treat people. That is how you treat people. You treat people with respect. You treat people with dignity no matter what they do, no matter what their job is. One of my favorite pictures of the president still is him walking in the White House, giving a fist bump to one of the janitors. It is how you treat people. It is how you see them.
Exactly.
It is inherently a part of who he is. And in quite honestly, and I don't do the whole Republican bashing, disparaging thing very much, but I honestly don't believe that Mitt Romney has that same feeling, that same sense, that same place in his heart where he sees all those people around him as being equal to him, as having a role to play, as being a part of a puzzle and a part of a team that takes you forward. I don't think he sees the world that way. And he would never, I can't imagine. And maybe this is my own shortcoming. I don't know, or my own feeling. I can't see Mitt Romney giving a fist bump to the janitor in the White House. I can't see that.
Oh, no. No, did you just see the picture of him floating around on YouTube where he was sitting in a classroom of black students and looked absolutely lost? Absolutely lost.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me at all.
in her remarks, she even went, when she did this school, from the janitor to the principal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that inclusion was there.
I think the most incredible quote out of the entire, and, you know, some people are going to take what I'm saying as, oh, my God, he believes that Michelle Obama overshadows the president. I'm not saying that. I think the quote that stuck with me the most was the one in which she says, being president doesn't change who you are. It reveals who you are. I believe the presidency is a crucible. I believe it is one of the most powerful crucibles that we have on this planet, in which you have to make incredible decisions, very difficult decisions, every single day, every single moment of every single day. And she has an incredible vantage point on her husband, and she has seen what that crucible has done, and she believes that it has revealed his character. And I think that the character that has been revealed has been a strong one.
Yeah, Leslie Guest mentioned that her favorite photo of President Barack Obama is when he was a senator and they made him a makeshift office down in the basement. And his shoes are off, his feet are up on the desk, and the shoes are totally worn out. We're going to go to another clip here. Michelle talking about the love for her husband.
I see how those stories, our collection of struggles and hopes and dreams, I see how that's what drives Barack Obama every single day. And I didn't think that it was possible, but let me tell you, today I love my husband even more than I did 4 years ago, even more than I did 23 years ago when we first met. Let me tell you why. See, I love that he has never forgotten how he started. I love that we can trust Barack to do what he says he's going to do, even when it's hard, especially when it's hard. Yeah, I love that for Barack, there is no such thing as us and them. He doesn't care whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or none of the above. He knows that we all love our country. And he is always ready to listen to good ideas. He's always looking for the very best in everyone he meets.
Well, a great deal of love there expressed.
Absolutely.
For her husband. And kind of had reminded me of that Charles Erlen tune, I Love You More Today Than I Did Yesterday.
Than I did yesterday.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's where
I think that's a powerful statement, too. I mean, I think you can see how political office can change the relationship between a husband and a wife.
Okay.
Excuse me, Arthur,
we have a caller on the line.
Sure.
Go ahead, caller. Tell us your name and where you're calling from. Are you there, caller? Okay, Arthur, we'll continue.
No worries.
Maybe they'll call back.
Mm-hmm. And I think the political positions and positions of power can change a relationship between a husband and wife, and often enough not for the positive. And to hear her say that about their relationship, I think is a huge thing. I think that's a very important part of his support, is who she is and who she is to him. And to hear that love expressed openly, to see the love that they express for each other openly, I think I love it. I mean, I know some people don't like public displays of affection and all the rest of that stuff, but to see them sitting in a basketball game and kiss each other, or to see them holding hands as they're walking off of the helicopter one, is just, I think all of that stuff is incredible. I love it.
Very
Maybe
incredible,
I'm just romantic.
Man. Okay, let's see if we have a caller on the line. Is Jennifer, are you on the line? Okay, we're going to go to the next clip then.
Okay.
Arthur, here we go.
But In 2009, the cavalry arrived, and our new president, Barack Obama, came in. He organized a rescue. He made the tough calls, and he saved the American auto industry. Now, you know, Mitt Romney, he saw the same crisis, and you know what he said? Let Detroit go bankrupt. Now, sure, Mitt Romney loves our lakes and our trees. He loves our cars so much, they even have their own elevator. But the people who design and build and sell those cars, well, in Romney's world, the cars get the elevator and the workers get the shaft.
Yeah, that was Jennifer Granholm, who is the former governor of the state of Michigan.
Right.
Comments,
right.
Arthur.
I couldn't agree with her more in many ways, just in terms of, you have to stand by the things that you say and the things that you do. And if Romney is going to try to say that he is a fan or in support of American workers, he's also going to have to stand by what he said about the auto industry. And I think that the president's vision in this particular case, his leadership in this particular case, when there are a lot of people saying, you know, we can't bet on these folks, I think he stood up and said, we can't let this fail. As much as you want to say that there are some banks that are too big to fail, there are some industries in this country that are too big to fail, and not because the corporations that stand behind them are too big, but because there are so many people dependent on them. And I think that is what the president saw.
Yeah, something like 3 out of 9 jobs,
mm-hmm.
3 out of 7 jobs are tied to the auto industry.
Yeah.
And you would think that Mitt Romney, his father was the governor of Michigan at one time, right?
Yep.
They would have a little more empathy for the auto industry, which I find very surprising.
I wonder if that connection is actually, in fact, part of why he doesn't. You know, I don't pretend to be inside Mitt Romney's head in any way, shape, or form, but I mean, I can imagine that growing up with that kind of work that his father was doing might have jaundiced him, jaded him in some ways towards the industry for some reason. Maybe some set of experiences in relation to his father's work at AMC was just very negative for him, and so when he saw that happening, he just said, you know, no, this isn't gonna work for me, or isn't something that I want to do, or, you know, saw it as his chance to get back in an industry that somehow either hurt his father or himself or his family, or I don't know. But, you know, ultimately, yeah. His statement it stands for itself, and he was wrong. He was wrong.
We're going to move to our next clip. This is Freedom Rider John Lewis on the road to the White House. Here we go.
Hello, America. I first came to this city in 1961, the year Barack Obama was born. I was one of the 13 original Freedom Riders. We were on a bus ride from Washington to New Orleans, trying to test a recent Supreme Court ruling that banned racial discrimination on buses crossing state lines. We tested the waiting room. We said our struggle was not against individuals, but against unjust laws and customs. Our goal was a true freedom for every American. Since then, America has made a lot of progress. We are a different society than we were in 1961. And in 2008, we showed the world the true promise of America when we elected President Barack Obama. A few years ago, a man from Rock Hill, inspired by President Obama's election, decided to come forward. He came to my office in Washington and said, "I am one of the people who beat you. I want to apologize. Will you forgive me?" I said, "I accept your apology." He started crying. He gave me a hug. I hugged him back, and we both started crying. This man and I don't want to go back. We don't want to go back. Moving forward, my dear friends, your vote is precious, almost sacred. It is the most powerful non-violent tool we have to create a more perfect union. Not too long ago, people stood in unmovable lines. They had to pass a so-called literacy test. Pay a poll tax. On one occasion, a man was asked to count the number of bubbles in a bar of soap. On another occasion, one was asked to count the jelly beans in a jar, all to keep them from casting their ballot. Today, it is unbelievable that there are Republican officials are trying to stop some people from voting. They're changing the rules, cutting polling hours and imposing a requirement intended to suppress the vote. The Republican leader in the Pennsylvania House even bragged that his state new voter ID law is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state. That's not right, that's not fair, and that is not just.
I want to say to our callers out there that we see you. We know you're there. We will open the lines at 9:45. 9:45, we'll open the lines to all those callers who are waiting. Okay, Arthur, ain't no turning back. You're going to turn us around now.
Well, you know, that of all of the things to kind of touch on with someone like John Lewis, who, you know, obviously has that historical perspective and that historical presence, I think is right up the alley of some of the things that my great-grandfather probably would have touched on, because when he worked to found the Niagara Movement and to found the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, he was fighting for that right to vote, and he would see, if he could be here and have the historical perspective, he would see that they were trying to turn the clock back, and he would say some very similar things as John Lewis said. We cannot go backward. We cannot afford to allow people to take away that right to vote. That is one of the most powerful things that we still have, much like you said, one of the most powerful nonviolent things that we have in the arsenal. And so,
and sacred.
I'm 100% behind. So, I'm sorry?
And sacred. He said it
and
was
sacred.
A sacred right. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. People have died for that. I've tried to enforce that or reinforce that with all of the young people that I talk to. When I give talks about my grandfather, I talk about his relevance to today. And that is right in the middle of it. It's this whole business about how hard they had to fight in order to actually make that right part of what we can hold up and say is ours.
And as you say, too many people have died, too many sacrifices, too many billy clubs upside the head, dog bites
right.
In the butt, and one what have you. We're going to come up with our next clip here. This is Senator Gabby on violence prior to the failed attempt at assassination, which left her damaged with a bullet in her head. Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is one of at least 10 members of Democratic leaders, who Democratic leaders say have been targeted because of their vote on health care. And she joins us this morning from Washington. Congresswoman, I guess my first question is, what happened to your office in Tucson? And do you have any doubt that this is a direct result of your vote on health care?
Well, obviously, we weren't there. The office closed after the health care vote, and sometime between midnight and 2 a.m., we were alerted that the front door of our office, which is a glass panel door, had been either kicked out, shot out, or just basically destroyed. Whether or not it was a direct effect, obviously, we weren't there. Obviously, the police are investigating, there are federal authorities investigating, but obviously, the coincidence of this happening is it's fairly likely, but obviously we don't know at this point.
Are you afraid? Are you fearful today?
You know, I'm not. We've had hundreds and hundreds of protesters over the course of the last several months. Our office corner has really become an area where the Tea Party movement congregates, and the rhetoric is incredibly heated. Not just the calls, but the emails, the slurs. So, I mean, things have really gotten spun up. I mean, you've got to think about it. Our democracy is a light, a beacon, really, around the world because we affect change at the ballot box and not because of these, you know, outbursts of violence in certain cases and the yelling and the, you know, it's just, you know, change is important. It's a part of our process, but it's really important that we focus on the fact that we have a democratic process. I mean, this is a situation where people don't, I mean, they really need to realize that the rhetoric and firing people up and, you know, even things, for example, we're on Sarah Palin's targeted list, but the thing is that the way that she has it depicted has the crosshairs of a gun sight over our district. And when people do that, they've got to realize there's consequences to that action.
Oh, my. Yeah, this was before the assassination attempt on her her office getting broken into,
right.
Kind of laying at that the feet of the Republican Party, or at least a faction of the Republican Party known as the Teabaggers.
Right.
Yeah,
I had not heard that before, and when I heard it, it just gave me chills because I mean, here's someone who clearly acknowledges that there is a threat and that there are actions being taken against her, at least her office, that are damaging and scary and shouldn't be happening. And then for her to turn around and say, you know, no, I'm not afraid. But then, as we know, two months later, come up against a bullet herself is, I don't know. I there are a lot of things, like she says, about this political process that seem out of control and that seem to be just spinning wildly in ways that just don't make any sense. And that is absolutely near the top of my list.
I think we have a clip of her at the convention leading the Pledge of Allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
She's now a former senator, however, and in this clip, she is at the convention leading the Pledge of Allegiance. Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, accompanied by Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
And to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for
powerful and tear-filled moment at the convention,
mm-hmm.
Pledge of Allegiance.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and you can hear and just the difference in the first clip and the second clip and her ability to enunciate and articulate the words and to think her way through to kind of where she needs to be and where she's going. I mean, you can just hear it in her voice. And it's just, I just don't get it. I don't understand how the politics can be so, I don't know, so divisive that we come to that, the taking of a life or the, the taking of lives and the ruining of lives in that way. It's just, I mean, yeah, the some of the things that the teabaggers and Republicans and other folks saying, you know, piss me off. Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
But that's another turning point in my life, was coming to that understanding that they have a right. They have a right to say what they want, to think what they want, to feel what they want, and they have a right to say it publicly and write it down, because I have the same right. I have the same right to say what I mean and what I think and what I feel, and to write it down, to say it in a university, to say it in the streets, to say it wherever I want, because I live in the United States, and I'm an American citizen, and so are they. But they do not have the right to take away anyone's life or their livelihood or their hope or the direction that they are going with their lives because they disagree with them. That's the line in the sand. That is the line in the sand. Speak mm-hmm. your piece. Speak it as loudly as you want to. I believe the Ku Klux Klan has the right to walk down the middle of any main street in this country. But I got this for you. You go to lynch somebody, you go to drag somebody to death behind the pickup truck, guess what? I'm coming looking for you. Because that's the line in the sand that we have to take.
We have to take. Yes, because hate does not discriminate.
Nope.
And the former senator, technology saved her. I mean, what technology can do today in the health industry, and it helped her survive. And here the president is trying to make that same technology available for the janitor and the principal.
Absolutely.
Which is remarkable.
Absolutely. Okay. I think that's an incredible, incredible piece of this puzzle, that when you stop and you look back at this presidency, let's just, you know, for being, you know, cynical about it, let's say that Obama does not get elected in this coming November. I can look back on his presidency and say, you spent your political capital on the right issue, because that issue impacts every single American. That issue of health, much like he said, as he was defending it, said, you know, hey, look, all of us at some point have to go to a doctor and deal with health issues, and that means this is going to affect everyone. A good choice.
Yeah, every one of us. And
yep.
Like you, I didn't know that first clip. I've heard that before, and it's just amazing that pattern was there. That, you know, apparently someone was stalking her from a long time. We're going to go to our next clip here, and this is former President Clinton on talking about working together.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go.
Working with, because we focus on solving problems and seizing opportunities and not fighting all the time. And here's what I want the people at home to think about. When times are tough and people are frustrated and angry and hurting and uncertain, the politics of constant conflict may be good. But what is good politics does not necessarily work in the real world. What works in the real world is cooperation. What works in the real world is cooperation. Los Angeles is getting green and Chicago is getting an infrastructure bank because Republicans and Democrats are working together to get it. They didn't check their brains at the door. They didn't stop disagreeing, but their purpose was to get something done. Now, why is this true? Why does cooperation work better than constant conflict? because nobody's right all the time, and a broken clock is right twice a day. And every one of us and every one of them, we're compelled to spend our fleeting lives between those two extremes, knowing we're never going to be right all the time and hoping we're right more than twice a day. Unfortunately, the faction that now dominates the Republican Party doesn't see it that way. They think government is always the enemy, they're always right, and compromise is weakness. Just in the last couple of elections, they defeated two distinguished Republican senators because they dared to cooperate with Democrats on issues important to the future of the country, even national security. They beat a Republican congressman with almost 100% voting record on every conservative score because he said he realized he did not have to hate the president to disagree with him. Boy, that was a non-starter, and they threw him out.
Okay, the politics of constant conflict.
Mm-hmm.
That was the master of the stump speech at his best, don't you think?
I absolutely do. I think that, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about former President Clinton is he has a knack for just delivering a line. It is amazing to listen to him talk. It's incredible. But I think the issues that he hit on, too, are also some of the most important ones in this particular campaign, because we have seen the constant conflict, and the need for cooperation is just incredible. The people of the United States are sick and tired of hearing all of the conflict going on in Congress and the inability to get anything done. I was listening to one of the other speeches at the DNC. It was by my governor, Governor Hickenlooper, John Hickenlooper, and he talked a little bit about how the government here has a very kind of similar situation, somewhat evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, we still are able to get things done. We are still able to make things move because we figure those things out. We figure out those issues and we work around them. And that's what the American people expect of Congress. And Congress simply has failed at that. And I think they need to be held accountable somehow.
Okay, we're going to move to our next clip right now. It's again Bill Clinton and talking about Obama's track record.
As the Senate Republican leader said in a remarkable moment of candor, 2 full years before the election, their number one priority was not to put America back to work. It was to put the president out of work. Well, wait a minute. Senator, I hate to break it to you, but we're going to keep President Obama on the job. Now, are you ready for that? Are you willing to work for it? Wait a minute. In Tampa, did y'all watch your convention? I did. In Tampa, the Republican argument against the president re-election was actually pretty simple, pretty snappy. It went something like this. We left him a total mess. He hadn't cleaned it up fast enough, so fire him and put us back in. Now, but they did it well. They looked good. They sounded good. They convinced me that they all loved their families and their children and were grateful they'd been born in America and all that. Really, I'm not being... They did. And this is important. I like the argument for President Obama's reelection a lot better. Here it is. He inherited a deeply damaged economy. He put a floor under the crash. He began the long, hard road to recovery and laid the foundation for a modern, more well-balanced economy that will produce millions of good new jobs, vibrant new businesses, and lots of new wealth for innovators. Now, are we where we want to be today? No. Is the president satisfied? Of course not. But are we better off than we were when he took office? Then, listen to this. Listen to this. The economy was in free fall. It had just shrunk 9.4% of GDP. We were losing 750,000 jobs a month. Are we doing better than that today? The answer is yes.
Well, their sole purpose is to get him out of office. That's why he's running into so many roadblocks over there in Congress. Really,
yeah,
not trying to help him at all.
I think that's exactly right. I think they've made a concerted effort to make sure that he's not the president again. Honestly, at some levels, I don't think it would have mattered who it was. I don't take that part of the Republican strategy as personally as some of my friends do. Some of my friends think it's a racial position that they're taking. I think it wouldn't have mattered what Democrat was in there. I think the Republicans would have done the same thing. I think they would have taken the same strategy. I think they would have taken the same line. It just so happens that it is Barack Obama and that he is the first African-American president. And so many people take it far more personally than they might have otherwise. Having said that, you know, I think, too, where Clinton is coming from is to say, you know what? We have to deal with the reality. The reality is when President Clinton left, we had a $1 trillion, approaching a $1 trillion surplus. And then when Bush left, we had hundreds of millions of dollars in deficit. And so it has been a huge thing to deal with, just that part. That's not to say anything about the housing bubble bursting or banks going under or any of the rest of that stuff. All of the rest of the issues that also came to the forefront. I don't think that many people in the United States give President Obama credit for dealing with what could have been a huge mess if he hadn't stepped in and done the things that he's done. Is it where he wants it to be, like Clinton said? No, he's not satisfied with where things are. I think he's just as much in touch with the many people who are still out of work as anybody else is. But I do believe that this situation would have been far worse had we had a Republican administration.
Mm-hmm. And there were some statistics that came out right after the Democratic convention that did not favor Obama too well. Any thoughts on that?
Which ones are you referring to?
Are you aware of those unemployment statistics that came out
right
at the close?
Yeah,
I
saw that. I saw those. I think that a number of things that came out right just then weren't immediately favorable for him. But I think what many people are saying is, yes, this is a slow recovery, far slower than people had anticipated and hoped for. But I also think that a lot of people can see there is some hope, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. I think one of the things that Clinton also said in his talk that was very interesting was to look back and talk about the speed at which economic recoveries happen. And he specifically pointed to some of the economic recoveries that were going on from the time that he went from his first term to his second term. And I think he had a lot of very good experience to put on the table for us to take a look at. And so when I see the numbers, the unemployment numbers, although that is something that is a deep concern for me, particularly because the unemployment numbers for African Americans are twice the national average, I also know that we are headed in the right direction. We are doing the right things. And if we were to do it the way the Republicans would have us do it, I just think rich people would get just that much richer and the middle class would end up going backwards.
Okay. You know, Clinton mentioned that he watched the Republican National Convention. Did you happen to look at any of it?
I saw bits
and pieces, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what was surprising for me is the absence of key Republicans. You know, Colin
Powell.
Speaking
of the Bushes?
The Bushes.
Mm-hmm.
The former Secretary of Defense. I mean, you know, Condoleezza Rice was the only
Karl
one.
Karl Rove.
Rove wasn't there. I mean,
right.
What's up with that, do you think?
I mean, I really think that the Republicans
Or is it the Republican Party anymore?
The Republicans are doing the very best that they can to distance them from the Bush administration because they know that as soon as they bring someone like that to the table, it's open season. It's already open season enough for people to remind, for the public to be reminded of the Bush administration's failings. To bring someone from that administration and to put them front and center as representative of what the Republican Party can do and wants to do and will do is deadly for them at this point because the things that happened in that administration are horrific. And the numbers speak for themselves. They absolutely speak for themselves. I don't blame them for avoiding Bush, but I read somewhere that that's the first time in any party's national convention that the most recent still living former president has not shown up or not been a part of that convention.
And so probably not invited.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
I want to make a correction. Condoleezza Rice was in attendance
at the
Republican National Convention and made a keynote address.
Right after she was accepted as a membership in the Masters, the golf club down in Georgia where the Masters are held.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. She got a
title
to wear a green jacket now.
Exactly.
Also, there was a tinge of racism got displayed there at the Republican National Convention in terms of the CNN African-American camera woman was pelted with peanuts and racial epithets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There
was a little flare-up there.
That seemed to me just to be, another one of those things that's representative of the folks there. And I know that the Republican Party would like to play that off as, just an anomaly and those folks are not representative of us. But, you can only say that so much. When so many things like that happen, you can only make excuses so many times. Folks have not been treated well in that party. And I'll tell you this in all transparency, my aunt, a cousin on my father's side of the family, was one of the founders of the Black Republican Council in the United States back many, many years ago. And she and I have our little differences about politics, obviously. But she herself, I think, would look at that situation. If she were on this show, she would look at that situation with the CNN reporter and be just absolutely appalled. And I can't imagine why Republicans did not step up to the plate and really come down very hard on the people who did that kind of stuff because it speaks to their character as a group.
Okay. Let us see if we have any callers. It's about 9:45 here. We're going to go to a last clip here. The clip is about 7 minutes. It's from Professor Gloria Brown Marshall. And then when we come back, we'll see if there's any callers who are waiting to make a comment or have a question. Okay, we're going to close the show now. Arthur, are you there?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
We're going to close now. We're about out of time, but we will end the show with the clip. that I just mentioned that is 7 minutes long from Professor Gloria Brown. Here we go.
Thanks, Professor.
Okay, thank you, Arthur. We'll talk
Appreciate
again.
Appreciate it. Sounds great.
Okay. Arthur, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, don't hang up.
Okay.
Okay, here we go with the clip.
We are here at the Tampa Bay Times Forum for the final day of the Republican Party's convention. It has been a tale of two conventions, one in which we have the pride and the enthusiasm, the passion of the Republican Party on full display. At the same time, we have a heinous act, a racial attack on a black female camera person working for CNN. First, the facts. On Tuesday, August 28th, a camera woman for CNN, who to this point has been unknown by name, had an attack, a racial attack, perpetrated against her by two white males, delegates or alternates, who were in attendance here in this arena. CNN has given a statement verifying that the attack did happen, yet they refuse to give any more information. This attack shows us that even though this grand old party, the party of Lincoln, has shown through the many speakers it's presented that there has been progress, there remains much more work to be done. On Wednesday, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice spoke to a cheering crowd. She received a standing ovation. However, that black female camera person who was racially assaulted was ignored, her voice silenced. And as Ms. Rice spoke of her overcoming obstacles, the fact that her mother said, although you cannot have a hamburger at the counter of the Woolworth stores because of segregation, you may one day grow up to be president. Unfortunately, Condoleezza Rice's story does not take into account the four black girls who were killed by Klansmen who bombed that Birmingham church in September of 1963. On Wednesday, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice spoke to a cheering crowd. She received a standing ovation. However, that black female camera person who was racially assaulted was ignored, her voice silenced. And as Ms. Rice spoke of her overcoming obstacles, the fact that her mother said, although you cannot have a hamburger at the counter of the Woolworth stores because of segregation, you may one day grow up to be president. Unfortunately, Condoleezza Rice's story does not take into account the four black girls who were killed by Klansmen who bombed that Birmingham church in September of 1963. As the Republican Party speaks time and time again through all of the very eloquent speakers over the time period of this convention, in the back there is a ghost haunting those who have failed to remember this country's history when it comes to racial segregation and racial inequality. Fannie Lou Hamer is the person who paved the way for people like Condoleezza Rice, Tim Scott, Mia Love, and yet it's as though all of those lives and all of those livelihoods lost in the effort to gain equality for black people in this country meant nothing. As B.B. Winans sings America in this very arena, we had several black politicians. Tim Scott of South Carolina. We had Mia Love, mayor of Sarasota Springs. And of course, Condoleezza Rice. All of these black Republicans spoke of the opportunities presented in America. And at the same time, hears almost nothing said of the racial disparities or this incident. And in the midst of the preparation for tonight's finale, we have to understand that the grand old party, which is touting freedom, opportunity, and the ability to rise above any circumstance, is ignoring a racial incident that took place right here in the Tampa Bay Times Forum. In this camera pit, a black female camera operator was racially assaulted by two adult white men, delegates or alternates to this convention. She worked for CNN, and it was during this time, during her time at work, that she was assaulted. They threw peanuts at her and called her an animal. The Republican National Convention released a statement indicating that, yes, this incident did take place. Yet, after condemning it, there was a silence. A silence that was also shared by CNN. CNN refused to release the name of this female camera person or have her give any statement of any kind. The Republican National Convention has not released the names of the two men involved. It's as though nothing ever happened. Regarding other racial incidents that have hounded the Obama administration throughout the last 4 years, the incident right here during this Republican National Convention makes one wonder, are the Republicans in the dark when it comes to racial inequality in this country, or are they just turning a blind eye? Yes, it's America, and in America there is a history of racial segregation that has been ignored for far too long. Apparently it's being ignored not just by the grand old party of the Republicans, but also by CNN. As America is sung in the background, we have to all ask ourselves, yes, progress has been made, but silence is not the price of progress. There should be a full investigation. Who are these two men who would perpetrate such a racial attack in 2012 at their own political convention? This is the ease with which people are allowed not only to act in such racially heinous ways, but to have those actions then covered up. Silence will only allow racial attacks to stay right below the surface and fester. We, America, need to own up to our history. Yes, this is a great country filled with opportunity and promise, but it is also a country with a very troubling past that has seeped into the present. We all have the power to make change, whether Democrat or Republican, but we have to know our past in order to better understand our present and move forward to a future for all.
Okay, that lady's name was Patricia Carroll, the camera lady that was assaulted,
mm-hmm.
and her name was released after Romney spoke the last night of the convention.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that, Arthur?
Yeah, I mean, I just think there needed to be more done around that, much like the reporter was saying. Because, you know, the Republican Party has been trying to reach out to Latinos and has been trying to reach out to African Americans in different ways. And much like she said, I think that is tarnished, deeply tarnished, all of that outreach, all of that work, because they did not respond to what happened to this woman in a way that befits the act against her. And I
I said it before you played that clip, and I'll say it again. They simply didn't step up, and it's reflective of all of them. It's not reflective of just the two men who did that. It's reflective of the entire Republican Party, and they can't continue to deny it when so many different things happen that are like that. It just they just are not proving that they've stepped into the shoes of Abraham Lincoln.
Mhm.
Like she said, the grand old party has come to this.
I'm sorry, the grand old party has come to earth. Is that what you said?
Has come to this. Has come to these kinds.
Oh yeah,
of things. It comes to this kind of behavior.
And is it really the grand old party anymore? Has it been infiltrated and taken over by the so-called teabaggers?
Yeah, I mean, I think the teabaggers have driven them, has dragged the party and driven the party further and further right. And I think that the Tea Party has caused the Republican Party to become some things that it might not have become otherwise. I really think there are a lot of people like myself who've been very energized, become very energized because of Romney's selection of Paul Ryan, who fits into that right side, that teabagger side very well, very comfortably. I think that selection has really galvanized many, many Democrats. I think it was the choice of someone who saw themselves losing and needing to make a real shift and make a real difference. And unfortunately, I think it's going to backfire on him. I think it's going to be something that is going to come back and bite him, because there are many people like me who are going to say, look, I can't deal with this guy. I can't have the thought of him being one step away from the presidency. No, I'm going to do whatever it takes to stop him.
Okay. Martha, let us get your closing remarks. And what would your grandfather, W.E.B. Du Bois, say to encourage voters to get out to the poll in great numbers?
I think it's very much like what John Lewis was saying. I think that we have fought long and hard for the right to vote. We have fought long and hard and died and been punished in many ways and challenged and tried in many ways to have that right. And for us, at this point, it is crucial and critical that we make sure that we step up and we support the president, the current president of the United States, because the choices for us between what he would bring to the table versus what the Romney-Ryan ticket would bring to the table are very stark, very important, and will impact people of color, and black people in particular, day by day by day. Anybody who is middle class, anybody who is poor in this country will lose ground under a Romney and Ryan administration. The people who are rich will get richer under that kind of an administration, much the same as it did, much the same as happened under the Bush administration. So I think the policies that they bring to the table, I think the things that they will do as part of that administration will be devastating to this country and to people like me. So I think Grandpa would stand up and say all of those things and many more if he were here to make that statement.
Okay, great. As always, I appreciate your coming on and having this conversation with us and listening
to
Arthur McFarlane, grandson of W.E.B. Du Bois, and we've been recapping and going over the Democratic National Convention, the highlights. Thanks a lot, Arthur. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Kristen. I appreciate
being
on.
Okay, take care.
You
we'll
too.
Be in touch.
Okay. Sounds great. Bye.
Bye-bye.